Welcome, everyone. You're listening to Horizontes, Latin America's Leadership Forum. Our focus is on developing business leadership in Latin America. That is, the skills and topics that leaders need to succeed. I'm John Price, your host. Horizontes is brought to you by America's Market Intelligence, the leading market intelligence consultancy for Latin America. Today, I'm excited to have a conversation with Adam Blanco, who is a rare gem in the Latin American business landscape because he is a bona fide Russia expert. Born and raised in the U.S., Adam found himself drawn to Russia after the wall came down and spent two decades building a fascinating career in diplomacy, international aid and development, finance, and trade, based mostly in Moscow. Today, Adam resides in Florida and runs a consultancy that bridges business interests in Russia, the U.S., and Latin America, deftly navigating the challenging regulatory and compliance roadmap that such ventures require. I first learned of Adam when I read his curiously titled newsletter, Barbershop Whispers, Russia, which provides a critical and objective analysis of Russian leadership, policymaking, and foreign relations from a decidedly Russian perspective. Once I'd read his newsletter, I knew I had to interview him. So without further ado, let's begin the interview with Adam Blanco. Adam, it's terrific to have you on the show to talk with you. I've enjoyed our conversations over the last year. I've enjoyed very much reading your newsletter about Russia and all things Russian. And it's just a thrill to have you and be able to steal an hour of your time and hear your thoughts and insights on Russia, particularly in light of what's happened this week. Thank you again for being here.
Thank you, John, for inviting me. I very much look forward to this discussion on Russia and its impact on Latin America and the global economy as a whole.
Terrific. Adam, we both reside in South Florida, and that is not a natural haunt for Russian experts. You are truly a rare gem in that geography, and I consider myself lucky to have found you and come across you. How is it that a Russian expert like yourself, first of all, became a Russian expert? Tell us a little bit about what took you to Russia and what you did in the several years that you spent there, and why it is that you continue to be engaged with the country.
Well, let me tell you, to start with, my background is banking. I'm an international banker by profession and an entrepreneur by passion. What brought me to Russia was the Peace Corps, for which I am very grateful. I often tell my kids that they are the product of Perestroika and John F. Kennedy, who started the Peace Corps. And I met my wife in Russia, and we've got a nice little family. I left the U.S. to go to Russia with the Peace Corps in 1991. Prior to that, I worked for Dresdner Bank and Banco do Brasil. What brought me there was, I guess, a little bit of adventure and idealism.
Fair enough. And after serving, I guess, a couple of years in the Peace Corps, you went on to do other things in Russia. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. I did my two-year tour in the Peace Corps. And after the Peace Corps, I did a number of things. I did a lot of economic development work for USAID, an agency of the State Department. I worked for Visa International. And I also worked for the Rolf Group. The Rolf Group was the largest importer and retailer of foreign-made cars in Russia. It was a multi-billion-dollar business started by Sergei Petrov. One out of every three foreign cars on Russian roads had come through us.
Okay. Well, what I love about your background is that, you worked in development, you worked in government, you worked in the financial sphere, you worked in trade. So your perspectives on Russia and how it engages in the world are truly diverse. One of the things that I think have baffled much of the world who doesn't have your kind of insider perspective on Russia, and we're now, recently past the 2-year anniversary of the invasion of Ukraine by Russian forces in 2022. And that is, why did Putin do this? What was his thinking? And what did he hope to achieve out of invading Ukraine again?
John, it baffled me as well when he invaded a second time. But then again, I thought more about it after the invasion. Let's start with first, Putin never accepted Ukrainian sovereignty. He and the Soviet era colleagues of his have never accepted Ukrainian sovereignty. I think there were two determining factors that led Putin to the second invasion. One is a perception of Western weakness in NATO. A lot of this was fueled by Trump's anti-NATO rhetoric. And then the January 6th insurrection further reinforced this in that Putin saw this happening. Well, the West doesn't have time for Ukraine. Why would they object? They didn't object when we invaded in 2014, when we invaded Crimea. The other determining factor, I think, that led to the invasion was flawed intelligence that was provided to Putin by Department 5 of the Federal Security Service, the FSB. They are responsible for providing intelligence on former Soviet states. And for Ukraine, Putin was told that the Ukrainians will accept Russian soldiers with flowers, and that the government would collapse. There are two other contributing factors that I will go over very quickly. One of them was Zelensky fatigue, in that Putin never really respected Zelensky. Zelensky doesn't come from an intelligence background or a government background. And Putin was frustrated in that he could not persuade Zelensky to give up Donbass in Crimea and end the war. The other factor was isolation. COVID hit in 2020. Putin was afraid. It would take weeks and medical tests to get a meeting with Putin. Remember the long table meeting with Macron that Putin had. Alexei Navalny, I should mention, described Putin very well as the old grandpa in the bunker. Putin became disconnected with the world as well as the people in Russia. So those are the contributing factors. I think you asked me what was the initial goal? Did you
Yeah,
ask? Yeah.
exactly. Yeah.
Well, the goal, I believe the ultimate goal was simply to remove Zelensky and install a Moscow-friendly government. I don't believe the goal was to take over and occupy all of Ukraine.
We hope you're enjoying this latest edition of the Horizontes Leadership Podcasts, a series of conversations designed to inform, instruct, and inspire Latin American business leaders. Entrepreneurs, politicians, business magnates, inventors, authors, subject matter experts, financiers, and cultural icons from across Latin America are among our guests. We hope you find these podcasts as compelling to listen to as we find them interesting to produce. If you wish to also receive our curated reading list of the latest articles, white papers, and interviews we circulate each week, write to us at horizontes@americasme.com. That's Horizontes at AmericasMI.com. And now, back to the Horizontes podcast.
So you don't buy into this sort of Soviet tank commander mentality where Russia is vulnerable on its Western Front and therefore needs to build a sort of buffer zone, much like it achieved with the Warsaw Pact after the Second World War, and they need to sort of rebuild that they lost over the last
year. Yeah, I don't necessarily believe that in its physical sense, but certainly I believe it in that Putin wants to retain influence on his near abroad, and near abroad being the former Soviet states as well as Eastern Europe.
Right. He needs to make sure that he needs to know that they're his allies and that they're not going to turn against him.
Right. And NATO, I believe, was always simply a pretext to the invasion.
Sure. So in light of the fact that, and I thank you for laying out the sort of justification and why he thought he might succeed, and clearly he hasn't succeeded in reaching those objectives. Ukraine is as determined to remain independent, and the West, although some would argue have not made the commitment to the war that they ought to, certainly help the Ukrainians stand up to the Russians and stop their advance. But what do you think are the biggest and most lasting damages to Russia that this war has caused?
Well, I think there are several, and I'll focus on three of them, really. And before I get there, let me tell you, Putin lost this war in the first 2 weeks of the invasion. The Ukrainians fought very hard, and the West at the beginning did support significantly to Ukrainian victory in pushing the Russians off. The damage, the lasting damage, let's start with the economy. The best and the brightest have left the country. Approximately 1.3 million highly skilled workers have left. They've gone to the United States. They've gone to Germany. They've gone to Turkey. They've gone to Dubai. Dubai is a hub of Russian business and exiles. That is going to weigh heavily on Russia's future global economic competitiveness, given its aging demographics and low birth rate. The other part of this from an economic standpoint is the country has shifted to a wartime economy. What does that mean? That means nearly 40% of federal budget goes towards the military-industrial complex, internal security, and the army. Let's not forget, this comes at the expense of social services and infrastructure. And this is also what led to the economic collapse of the Soviet Union. So that is from the economy, on the economy. Other lasting consequences of this is Russia's influence on its near abroad, that being the Soviet states, the former Soviet states. Many of them are rethinking their relationships with Russia. An example is Azerbaijan with Turkey, Armenia with the US, Kazakhstan with China. So Russia's influence in Central Asia and the Caucasus are weakening because of this war. Another consequence is the strengthening of NATO, the EU, and Ukraine itself. This war, Putin, was a catalyst to uniting NATO, giving NATO purpose. At one time, Macron questioned whether NATO is brain dead or not. And this was less than a year before the second invasion. So those are I see as the lasting consequences on Russia.
Yeah, that's a laundry list of damages. And it seems that the war, from Russia's perspective, is simply not sustainable and is being upheld really by the willpower of Putin and a few of his cronies. So given the heavy toll on Russia that this war has exacted and will continue to exact, what do you foresee as the most likely scenario for the war in Ukraine, say, by the end of this year, 2024, and alternatively by the end of the decade?
I think, John, the 2024 is going to be a period of regrouping and rearming for both Ukraine and Russia. Putin is in this for the long term, and the federal budget shows that. Putin is also looking to see, he's testing Western political will in their commitment to Ukraine. And we are seeing that. We are seeing that in real time now with the EU passing Ukrainian aid of some, I believe it's 50 billion euro. And in the United States, Congress holding up $60 billion worth of Ukrainian aid. I don't see this coming to an end anytime soon. This is going to be a long war. This will go to 2025, maybe even 2026. How it ends, I don't know. There are many scenarios. It's too early to tell. Neither side, I believe, is in a position to sue for peace.
Yeah, it's particularly baffling, the lack of political support in the United States for arming Ukraine, for two reasons. Number one, most of the weaponry that Ukraine relies upon from the U.S. and has been supplied thus far are old weapons and old ammunition that are so old. Although their book value might be billions, they are literally months away, if not a couple of years away, from being destroyed.
Yes, that is true. That is very true.
And so on the books, it looks like a big give to Ukraine, but this equipment would literally be thrown out if it wasn't given to Ukrainians.
Very true.
And the other that I just don't understand is, you know, for a country like the United States that has spent trillions of dollars in 40 years, more if you go back to the beginning of the Cold War, fighting the Russians, they now have a proxy, Ukraine, who's willing to sacrifice its own treasure and, of course, its own blood to beat or at least weaken America's, you know, enemy of 70 years for pennies on the dollar. And I just don't understand. I think it's a really sad state of affairs that
it actually leads to a separate podcast, John.
Yeah, sure. It's a big topic. Look, this was a big week in Russia. Alexei Navalny, who many saw as the only opposition leader that could possibly replace Putin in a sort of bloodless coup, or even better, a democratic change of government, he died. He died under what is still suspicious terms. Nobody really knows. I understand you met Alexei Navalny, and I'm sure you have a strong opinion of him, like many Russians do. What was he like, and what was he to Russia and to particularly younger Russians? What did he symbolize? And what do you think his passing, how do you think that's going to change Russia's commitment to this war, for instance?
Yeah, that it was a very, very difficult weekend, John. Navalny was an imperfect human being, as we all are. And that was part of his attraction. with the younger generation. He was charismatic. He was young, ambitious. He exposed the massive corruption that takes place in Russia at the federal level. He spoke about his family. His family would attend protests with him. In contrast to Putin, Putin never speaks about his family, never speaks about the two daughters or the kids that he's had with Alina Kabayeva. Navalny is the only opposition leader, the only movement that has actually created a grassroots opposition movement with a nationwide network in Russia during Putin's reign. Now, while that network has been dismantled, it still exists in the hearts and minds of young Russians. What happens next with the Navalny movement, I think really it becomes more powerful. Yulia Navalnaya has taken over the reins of the anti-corruption foundation, which has been sent in exile. And she has always been a powerful force behind Alexei. I would say watch this space, especially with the March elections coming up. The March elections will be held over a three-day period. The Navalny's movements has always been very innovative and creative in expressing their opposition to the Kremlin. The movement is a family operation. It's not just Alexei, it's the family and his friends and a large number of young Russians who want to see a better Russia.
The Horizontes Leadership Forum is brought to you by America's Market Intelligence, the region's leading consultancy and advisory firm, serving companies operating in Latin America and Caribbean markets for over three decades. AMI's vast network of consultants located in every major market in the Americas gather vital market intelligence from privileged sources that our industry practice leaders turn into insightful analysis to help our clients, some of the largest investors in Latin America, make vital business decisions. Before you decide to invest, launch a product, choose a partner, enter a market, or acquire a business, make sure your decision is an informed one. Find us at americasmi.com. That's americasmi.com. And now, back to the Horizontes podcast.
And of course, a leader like him or his wife, and the change that that would symbolize and the new face of Russia that it would symbolize would go a long way to changing the world perception of Russia and its willingness to work with Russia, to trade with Russia, to collaborate with Russia. That may not happen anytime soon, but even if it did, there are other factors of strong distrust of Russia, particularly in Western Europe, particularly in Germany. One of the biggest commercial displacements economic displacements of this war has been, of course, the severing of ties between Russian suppliers of energy and other products to Western Europe. And also, of course, more generally, the West, i.e. U.S., European, even Japanese companies severing ties after spending three decades investing and growing enterprises in Russia. What do you foresee becomes of these commercial ties? Can they be rekindled? What would it take? How long might that take?
I think the commercial ties, John, can be rekindled, but it will take decades, maybe even two generations for that to happen. The distrust, it runs deep, particularly in the Baltics and in Ukraine, of course, and in Poland. When you talk about the investments in Russia, foreign investment, foreign direct investments, the likes of Ford, Renault, Danone, Starbucks, it's going to take a long time before those come back. Those have been taken away. They have left the country. They've left billions and billions of dollars of investment in Russia. What needs to happen? At minimum, a ceasefire, certainly a new government. I do not see how foreign direct investment will be rekindled with Putin in power.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think also for a lot of Western European countries, particularly Germany, who became over-reliant on Russian gas, that's not a mistake they're going to re-embrace, even with the cost advantages of Russian gas and how that benefits
that's
German
right.
industry. You know?
That's right. And let me add to that. Those markets for Russia, I believe, are permanently displaced. That has been substituted with American LNG, renewables, solar and wind, and Norwegian gas. Norway is now the largest supplier of natural gas to Europe. They've replaced Russia with that.
Right,
so
right.
It's going to take a very long time, I believe.
So the other big actor beyond Western Europe, of course, in the Russian sphere, and who's been busily, I would say, finding advantage out of this chaos has been China. Chinese companies have gone in and replaced a lot of the supply that came from Western companies. They've made some investments in Russian enterprises. And of course, they are the natural new buyer for a lot of energy if it can be transported economically from Russia to China. What's your take on this new, more robust, but probably potentially problematic relationship between Russia and China?
Well, as Putin often says, the relationship with China is friendship without limits. Well, the truth is, it is friendship with limits. What is Russia's value to Chairman Xi? Let's look at this from the standpoint of global GDP, which is approximately 109 trillion. China represents 11% of that. Russia represents 2.5% of that. Chairman Xi is very ambitious. He wants to be the number one global economy. He wants to take Russia to the top. Well, China. He wants to take China to the top. Russia is an anchor to that. He's not going to be able to do that with Russia. So he's being very, very cautious on how he moves forward and how he interacts with Russia. A metric to watch here is the nature of trade between the two countries. China receives raw materials from Russia, while Russia buys value-added goods like cars. Let me give you an example. When I worked for the Rolf Group, the Russian roads were filled with European and US cars. Today, they're filled with Chinese cars. This doesn't bode well for Russia. There is no technology gain in this relationship. I'll give you another example. Military hardware and banking services. China's very careful not to anger the West. It has too much to lose, as I said earlier. Xi has his own problems in China with high youth unemployment and housing real estate. He has greater ambitions. Russia is increasingly becoming a vassal state of China, highly dependent on the Chinese economy. I'm not sure if I answered your question.
No, absolutely. And extending that and sort of looking forward, you know, everybody is well aware of the rising importance of India as a country that through innovation, through education, through more open trade and the deregulation of its economy, which it has done an admirable job of in the last 20 years, is going to be a massive economic player and through that exercise greater diplomatic power, et cetera. And both India and China, of course, are reliant on natural resources, the kind of natural resources that Russia has. And Russia, many of its weaknesses can be shored up by allying more deeply with India and China, probably, you know, pitting one against the other. This seems to be a potential winning exit for Russia going forward, a country with a shrinking population, with less and less access to technology, but with this incredible resources. If it's not oil, then it will be, you know, lithium and rare metals going forward.
Sure.
So this is, you know, geopolitics in its most ambitious level of discussion. But how do you foresee Russia's future as a country that can benefit from these two rising economic powers, China and India?
Yeah, that's a good question, John. Russia will continue to supply minerals, hydrocarbons to the rest of the world, including India and China. That's not going to change in the near future. The Asia issue reminds me of a book written by Peter Hopkirk, The Great Game, in which he talked about the battle between the British and Russian Empire over Central Asia. This game continues, only the competing parties now are the Russian Federation, China, in the US. India plays some role in this as well. To me, it is similar. The Central Asian countries are looking at their position right now in the same way that Ukrainians looked at their choice between an economic alliance with the European Union or Russia. Central Asian countries are looking at, what is our economic alliance? Is it with Russia or is it with China?
The Horizontes Leadership Forum is brought to you by America's Market Intelligence. Each year, AMI's most senior practice leaders, led by your podcast host, John Price, are invited by over 50 conference, seminar, and private business meeting organizers to provide their insights, predictions, and opinions concerning the most pressing business trends and challenges of the day in the Americas. To learn more about how your next regional planning meeting or conference can be enhanced by a presentation from AMI's leadership team, visit us at americasmi.com. That's AMERICASMI.com. And now, back to the Horizontes podcast.
Fair enough. That is definitely going to be an area of fascination over the next 50 years. And like I say, this may be Russia's sort of 2.0 opportunity here, is supplying these two behemoth powers that just really lack natural resources. I want to bring the conversation a little bit back to our part of the world, and the part of the world where the listeners of this podcast come from, and that's Latin America. And I think there's a lot of misinformation as to both the scope of Russian engagement today, commercial engagement in Latin America, and as well as the strategic intentions behind that engagement. And could you tell us what you think? Is Russian engagement today in Latin America, is it driven by sort of state-sponsored strategy, i.e., you know, Putin, FSB, and the Russian government, or is it really driven more by private interests and private sector interests?
That's a good question, John. Given the history of Latin America and Soviet Union, particularly Cuba, Nicaragua, Russia's involvement in Latin America, I would say, is sporadic. And it's mostly political, anti-American, disinformation. At the moment, Russia is preoccupied with Ukraine, with the war, and the Middle East. Russia has an interest in Syria in particular, where they have their only warm water port outside of Russia. They do not have the resources to deploy to Latin America. The exception here, I would say, is Venezuela, where they have both a political interest and an economic interest. And that economic interest is Rosneft. One can argue that that is a private sector interest, but it really isn't. Rosneft does really what the Putin government wants it to do. It's headed by Igor Sechin, and they have a deep interest in Padvesa in Venezuela. I do not see Russia as a major player in Latin America, or even a destabilizing player in Latin America. In fact, I would venture to say that the U.S. is actually gaining political and economic influence in Latin America, and a lot of this is being driven by nearshoring, factories leaving China and setting up in Mexico and other Latin American countries.
Yeah, no, fair enough. I think you're right about the reascendancy of American interests in the region. And I think that Russian interests are limited, and they include both political, as you say, ambitions, as well as private sector. I'm certainly aware of a couple of different Russian mining companies that essentially set up in Latin America to get around the sanctions that they're facing.
That's right. Yes.
Yeah. Adam, you publish an absolutely superb newsletter on a regular basis that delves into very deeply into what's going on in Russia, what's driving Russian engagement with the rest of the world, and certainly what Russia's intentions are in the Ukraine and in other foreign theaters. I've enjoyed reading it, and it thanks to that newsletter, that's what led me to you, meeting you in person. I'd love to make anyone listening aware of that newsletter and where to find it. So where might they find that?
Thank you, John. The newsletter is called Barbershop Whispers Russia, and you can find it on the Substack platform. And that would be www.substack.com, and you search for Barbershop Whispers. And we are a weekly publication. We cover all things that are Russia, focusing on Russian business, geopolitics, and domestic politics. We also have a independent contributors piece that comes out twice a month.
Fantastic. Like I said, I've really enjoyed it, and I applaud you for that effort. Adam, what a pleasure it's been to spend some time with you, pick your brain on Russia, and just develop a much more robust and thorough understanding of that country and its influence on the global stage, including Latin America. So thank you for sharing your thoughts with us, and look forward to our next conversation. Thank you for joining us for another Horizontes podcast, where we discuss key topics and challenges facing Latin American business leaders, featuring expert guests from a variety of fields and backgrounds. Horizontes is brought to you by Americas Market Intelligence, the leading Latin American market intelligence consultancy. We gather the research, conduct the analysis, and form the recommendations in the bespoke fashion that companies require to make wise business decisions in Latin American and Caribbean markets. You can find Horizontes on all major podcast directories like Apple, Amazon, Spotify, and more. Or you can visit our website, americasmi.com, and look for Horizontes under the Thought Leadership menu.